Chapter 4, Dog Training Revolution, The Key Principles. I've been a dog trainer for more than 12 years now, and in that time, I've had the honor of working directly with thousands of dogs and reaching millions of people through YouTube and television. I have the greatest job in the world, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. However, during these years, I've seen a lot of things in my industry that fly in the face of common sense and ethics. Even though many studies have shown that dogs learn better through positive reinforcement training than through force and intimidation, far too many traditional trainers either don't know this or are unwilling to accept it. Many of them talk about the importance of being the alpha. They advise people with dogs to yank and pop leashes, knee their dogs in the chest to stop them from jumping, and flip them onto their backs to show them who's boss. Most use devices such as metal choke chains and electric or prong collars. They tell people that their dogs might try to take over their lives due to underlying control issues, even though there's no real evidence to back that up. Such ideas of being dominant or the pack leader have become so popular and ingrained in the dog training world that I've become motivated to speak out against these old-fashioned beliefs. Many people trust the professionals who perpetuate these ideas and follow their advice, thinking they're doing right by their dogs. Instead, they are actually teaching their pets to behave just to avoid discomfort and pain, not because they have learned to communicate effectively with them. I'll show you what's possible when you focus on establishing a loving relationship with your dog rather than relying on the same old misinformation that's been around for ages. My goal is clear and simple: to continue helping to disrupt the dog training industry and to steer it toward more ethical practices while inspiring a new generation of people to connect with their dogs in a way they've never been taught before. There are very effective, humane ways of training dogs, completely backed by science, and I'm going to share them with you throughout this book. I'm passionate about doing anything I can to help encourage progress in the way we teach our dogs. The next two chapters will focus on specific how-tos of training, such as house training, walking on a leash, and sit and stay. This one will give you all the fundamentals you need no matter what you're teaching your dog. I'll explain the guiding principles of my training method so that you too can become part of the dog training revolution. 8 common myths in dog training. Before I delve into the training methods that really work, first, I'll shed some light on commonly held misconceptions about dogs to make sure we're starting off on the same page. Myth number 1, dogs are domesticated wolves, so you need to establish yourself as pack leader. Truth. Have you ever heard the surefire way to be a good dog trainer is to be the alpha? I did years before I became a dog trainer, and even I thought it sounded reasonable at the time. Dogs descended from wolves, and wolves supposedly live in hierarchical packs. So it made sense. Actually, there's little to no truth behind this idea. No one is arguing that dogs aren't descendants of ancient wolves. They certainly are. However, dogs are not wolves, but unique animals predisposed to learn very advanced concepts from human beings. We likely first selectively bred today's domestic dogs at least 15,000 years ago to cohabitate with us, provide companionship, and perform certain tasks such as hunting, herding, or alerting us when a stranger was near. To ignore the human influence in the domestic dog reflects a failure to acknowledge why the modern dog even exists at all. Yet many mainstream dog trainers seem to completely disregard this central point in favor of using methods that undermine the intelligence of our dogs. Also, these trainers are basing their philosophy on an archaic understanding of wolf behavior that has been discredited by researchers who study wolves extensively. In the 1940s, animal behaviorist Rudolf Schenkel found that when wolves are forced into captivity, they fight for top status, or what he referred to as the alpha. For decades, this concept reigned in the dog training world, and one of the world's leading wolf experts, L. David Meach, discussed it extensively in his popular 1970 book. However, 30 years later, Meach himself completely refuted the alpha wolf concept, so much so that he has pleaded with his publisher to stop printing the previous book. He found through his own extensive research that the dog training industry was basing their teachings on a highly artificial situation. Yes, when wolves are randomly placed in confinement together, they do fight for resources. However, that happens only when these animals are in a very unnatural environment. Wolves in the wild, the wolves that our dogs descended from, get to the top of their pack merely by maturing, mating, and producing offspring, says Meech. In fact, leadership roles are simply parental roles. The pack is actually a family social structure a lot like human families. It baffles me that many mainstream trainers are still promoting ideas that have long been rejected by the very experts who study this topic most. Any training ideology that relies on your being a pack leader or an alpha instead of a loving parent to your dog is fundamentally flawed from day one. Myth number two, domination is the only way to get a dog to listen to you. Truth, real teaching is about communication, not domination. Our goal when teaching a dog should not be to make a dog do something by forcing her into submission, but to make a dog want to do something. Trying to dominate your dog by yelling at her, flipping her on her back in an alpha role, or using certain collars designed to create discomfort or pain will only greatly hinder both your relationship with your pet and the training process. I know this can be confusing because many well-known trainers promote such dominant techniques. However, what we are really communicating to a dog when we rely on these tools is, if you do something I don't like, even if it's something that comes naturally to you, like walking fast or chasing a squirrel, I'm going to make you uncomfortable. Such training focuses on teaching what a dog shouldn't do rather than what she should do. Can these methods be effective? If your definition of effective is getting mediocre results, then yes, to some extent, they can be. I suppose if I thought I'd experience something unpleasant every time I walked a bit too fast, I'd obey too. But there's a price to pay for this. Your training will not be as effective and enjoyable as it could be for both you and your dog, and such tactics could even undermine your dog's trust. Furthermore, your dog will not behave consistently when you take those special collars off or don't use forceful methods. When you rely on an external device to get what you want, it's simply a crude patch designed to combat the unwanted behavior rather than to emphasize good behavior. And when that patch isn't there, dogs know the difference and often go right back to the unwanted behavior. It's as though they think, oh, I'm not wearing that unpleasant collar now, so I can do whatever I want. Some people might argue that while positive training is okay for some breeds, other breeds need forceful, punishment-based training because they are aggressive, powerful dogs. Let me respond to that. First, while some dogs may be more challenging or have aggression issues, that's definitely not specific to breed. As I explained in Chapter 1, the whole idea that certain breeds, such as pit bulls, have violent tendencies is completely false. When you hear stories of such dogs attacking other animals or people, it's usually because either they have been trained to do so by a human or they have more serious underlying issues. Of course, if you have a larger dog, it's particularly important to make sure she doesn't lunge on the leash or jump up on people simply because she can cause more harm than, say, a Yorkie due to her size. But that applies to any larger dog, from a German Shepherd to a Golden Doodle, and has absolutely nothing to do with breed. Positive training works with virtually any dog. In fact, if you do have a dog with aggression issues, studies have shown that using forceful methods will likely make the behaviors worse. For instance, one study in the Journal of Applied Animal Behavior found that confrontational methods such as striking dogs, intimidating them, alpha roles, and staring them down often led to an aggressive response. In almost all cases, dogs are aggressive because they are afraid and feel threatened in some way, explains Megan Heron, DVM, DACVB, lead author of the study and director of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at The Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. When you use confrontational methods, you are just making yourself more threatening and increasing your dog's motivation to use aggression against you. It's like fighting fire with fire. What about dogs who do seem to reduce their aggressive behaviors in the face of these methods? Sometimes people can scare their dogs enough that the animals achieve a state of learned helplessness. They just sit and take it, even though they're exhibiting signs of panic, such as an increased heart rate and panting, Dr. Heron explains. Some of these dogs eventually lose this inhibition and their aggression comes back much worse than before, as though they've snapped. And for those who don't, they remain shut down and often live in a state of perpetual fear. I'd hope that anyone who thinks this is acceptable would strongly reconsider the way they approach teaching dogs. Myth number three, Only puppies can learn new things. Truth. Apparently, this line of thinking has been around a long time. In 1534, an Englishman named John Fitzherbert wrote in the Book of Husbandry, "The dog must learn it when he is a whelp, or else it will not be, for it is hard to make an old dog to stoop." Today's translation, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I know that cliches often have a good bit of truth to them, but that's definitely not the case with this one. I've worked with thousands of dogs, and I can attest that you can most certainly teach dogs of all ages just about anything. More than half the dogs I've worked with in my career were adult dogs, not puppies. I even had a dog in one of my basic training classes who was 14 years old. He did wonderfully and passed with flying colors. And to this day, I enjoy teaching new concepts to my own dogs, who are all in double digits now. In fact, I recently taught Alpha Centauri to run outside, pick up a package from my front yard, and bring it back into the house. He doesn't mind the rain like I do. Bottom line, dogs simply love to learn at all ages, and you should always continue teaching them new tricks and concepts to keep them mentally stimulated. No offense to Mr. Fitzherbert, but don't buy into this old idea for a second. Myth number 4. Positive training means never disciplining your dog. Truth. Just because you're not forcing your dog into submission doesn't mean you're going to let her walk all over you. Positive training does include consequences for unwanted behaviors, but it's very different from the aggressive methods of traditional trainers. I have no problem with communicating that you do not like something your dog does. If you catch your dog getting into the garbage, telling her, "No, don't do that," in a calm voice, and then removing access to the trash is very logical to me. Or, in the case of jumping on guests, removal from the environment for a few minutes in a good old-fashioned timeout can be very effective too. The problem comes when you start saying no a lot more often than you say yes. If this is the case, then you are reacting to your dog's actions rather than taking the appropriate initiative to teach her how you'd like her to behave. The goal is to show your dog the behaviors you do like, so the emphasis is more on the positive. So, after you remove the garbage and get your dog to sit and focus her attention on you, then reward the positive behavior. Follow through and go that extra mile. When you learn to snap into training mode and follow through like this, you'll start to see dramatic acceleration in your results. Do I physically correct a dog from time to time? You bet I do, but only in rare circumstances. Here are the criteria I apply when putting my hands on a dog or forcing her to do something. Would I correct a 3-year-old child in the manner I'm about to correct this dog? If not, then I don't do it. Here's an example. Let's suppose I'm standing on a street corner with my dog on leash sitting next to me. Suddenly, there's a distraction across the street and my dog attempts to run into the street toward it. I certainly will restrain my dog and walk away from the distraction abruptly in the same way that I would grab a child's hand and pull her away from something that put her in harm's way. By definition, this is a physical correction. However, I limit physical corrections to when I'm preventing my dog from potentially being injured or causing harm to another being. Keep in mind, however, that a correction like the one I just described is a far cry from a restrictive, aggressive pop with a metal collar around a dog's throat. There really is no comparison. Lastly, keep in mind that even the physical correction I just described is not ideal. As you'll learn throughout this book, when you effectively prepare your dog for certain situations, then for the most part, no physical correction will ever be necessary. Myth number 5. Once you use treats, your dog will never listen without them. Truth. You can definitely wean off treats. However, people often expect that once their dog has demonstrated she understands a particular concept or trick with a treat, she should immediately start doing it without one all the time. That usually doesn't work. If your dog refuses to do something without a treat, this likely means you have attempted to cut treats out of the equation too early and your dog doesn't yet get it. Your dog will certainly learn to listen without treats, but you'll probably need to use them longer than you intuitively might think, possibly up to 6 months after she first learns a behavior. However, I'm talking about your dog knowing a skill completely. For her to do that, she'll need a lot of repetition and have to practice under various circumstances. For instance, say your dog sits for you when you're at home alone, even if you don't give her a treat. However, when you take her to the park, where there are a lot of distractions, she doesn't. That's because dogs don't generalize well. In fact, the single biggest thing you can do to throw your dog off is to change her environment or other variables. When you do, you'll need to reteach that skill or trick in the new environment. Using a lot of treats or other rewards with sincere encouragement simply motivates your dog to do the behavior under a variety of circumstances those first several months, which is more important than insisting she does it without a treat right away. Also, once you think your dog knows a skill completely, don't just cut out the treats cold turkey. Instead, I recommend following the principle of intermittent reinforcement. You might notice that after first teaching your dog something new, a time when you should reward heavily, that you might be able to get a free one without treating. That's because you are keeping your dog guessing. Dogs really excel when you randomly reward, and the goal is to make sure that yours can't decipher a pattern. So, you avoid a pattern by mixing it up. Perhaps give her a treat for a particular behavior, then skip the treat the next two times your dog does it, and then treat three times in a row. People may argue that using treats is bribery, but I promise you it's not. Remember, one of the most important elements of my training program is learning how to communicate with your dog, and treats will help you do just that. They are a catalyst that helps keep your pet's attention on you and encourages her by letting her know that she's on the right track. On top of that, researchers who have studied dogs' brains found that while food does motivate dogs, they are also greatly influenced by social interactions with humans. I couldn't agree more. While you still need to use treats at first to ingrain the particular behavior you're looking for, combining that with lots of love and genuine sincerity will only encourage your dog further. So, my goal isn't to get my dogs to sit when I ask them only because they might get a treat. I want them sitting because they are listening to me, respecting me, enjoying my attention, and trusting that I have their best interests at heart. Myth number 6. Behavior such as jumping indicate that your dog is trying to control you. Truth. This one really gets me. Your dog is not attempting to initiate a coup when she jumps up on you after you return home from work. Look at her body language. Her ears are probably pinned back, her tail is wagging, and if she could talk, she'd probably say, "I missed you so much. Let's go do stuff together." I call this enthusiasm and joy, and I'm not really sure how this is so commonly confused with dog-to-human dominance. When dogs exhibit behaviors such as tugging on the leash or jumping on guests, it's not because they're trying to assert dominance as part of their overall strategy aimed at achieving a higher status in your family. Also, doing things such as letting your dog through doorways first, allowing her on your bed, and feeding her before you eat is certainly not going to make her think she's now in control. These are ideas based purely on myths. So, what are behaviors such as excessive jumping or leash lunging really all about? I know that when dogs act out, it almost always has to do with a lack of the kind of exercise that engages both the mind and body, like fetch or other dog sports. Here's an example. I once worked with a dog named Lafitte, a very energetic dog who had the unusual habit of, well, lunging and attacking full-size trees. Lafitte is no small dog either. And when he did this, it was a sight to see. I know that many trainers would simply say that Lafitte is a dominant dog, slap a choke chain on him, and yank away until he was defeated and exhausted. However, I figured Lafitte was a dog with a lot of pent-up energy who didn't have a regular outlet to release it. While his primary person, Rachel, certainly tried, it was hard to keep up with his demanding needs all of the time. Lafitte didn't care about achieving dominance, he just wanted to do something, anything, even if it meant that the best way to release some energy was to use the closest tree as a toy. Sure enough, after spending some time with him in a single training session, I was able to teach Lafitte the concept of not attacking trees. Rachel also started playing with him on a more regular basis and has reported that his behavior has improved greatly. I elaborate on the specific issue of leash pulling in Chapter 7, but the bigger point here is that I taught Lafitte without trying to dominate him or cause him discomfort. I simply took the time to first understand why he was behaving in a certain way and then took steps to preempt that behavior by communicating in a way that encouraged him to listen to me. Myth number 7. Dogs can't understand that much, so speak in very simple terms. Truth. This is one of my biggest pet peeves. Most trainers advise you to keep your phrasing very simple and limit your requests to one word at a time. They say that dogs can't understand all that much, so the fewer words you use with your dog, the better. There's certainly validity to this when introducing a brand new concept, like sit, but there's nothing wrong with evolving your language after the first few weeks of basic training. Saying, sit down, please, have a seat, or whatever else you want to say to your dog can actually help broaden their vocabulary. Personally, I love being able to interact with my dogs by using everyday speech. Several studies have shown that dogs can have a huge vocabulary comparable to a toddler's. Stanley Coren, PhD, a leading expert in canine intelligence and author of How to Speak Dog, Mastering the Art of Human-Dog Communication, among other titles, has found that the average dog can learn at least 165 words. Highly intelligent dogs can learn 250 words or even considerably more. One Border Collie, named Chaser, holds the current known record at more than 1,000 words, and she most certainly understands some sentences and grammatical semantics. I know she's an outlier, but her story shows that dogs are a lot more capable than most people think they are. I can verify that dogs can understand simple sentences, provided you speak this way often. That's not to say that you shouldn't use one-word requests, such as sit and stay, but you don't have to always limit your phrases to one word at a time. You also don't have to worry that you're going to confuse your dog. They understand slight nuances in language and context just as we do. My own dogs clearly know the difference between let go and let's go. Also, years ago, when I used to perform with my dogs in stunt dog shows, I would say down please to tell them to get off a platform they were standing on. This did not confuse them when I'd later asked them to lie down by saying yet again, down please. There's also no need to dumb down your grammar. If your dog is barking, for instance, you can abandon phrases such as no bark. Instead, use proper grammar by saying stop barking, please, and teach your dog your language as you would teach a young child. Feel free to speak in a way that comes naturally. You'll be shocked by what your dog can understand. Myth number 8. You can teach your dog only one thing at a time. Truth. Dogs are remarkably intelligent and capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time. Just like humans, your dog can process many concepts simultaneously. Of course, I'm not saying to go crazy here and expect your dog to master 10 tricks or skills in one day. There's a fine line between covering multiple concepts and confusing your dog. You'll have to find that line with your own dog, but a general rule of thumb is between 2 and 4 simple tasks at a time. As for me, I like to introduce the concepts of sit, down, up, and stand in the same training session with most dogs. See Chapter 6 to learn how to teach this. That's 4 things. You are not only encouraging your dog to multitask mentally, which is great exercise for her brain, but also planting the seeds for more intermediate or advanced skills down the road that require more than one step. Most importantly, don't think you have to completely perfect a concept before moving on to the next one. Many people assume they need to, say, master house training before they move on to basic training, as though it's sequential. Again, I want to make sure that this is not your mindset. While you're house training your dog, you should work on other basic skills. Dogs want to work with humans, and by encouraging your dog to learn lots of things, you're only speeding up her success. Key training principles. Now that you know which myths are either preventing or slowing progress when it comes to teaching our dogs, let's go over the fundamentals that truly work. Put simply, if an outcome to a behavior is positive, then the dog is likely to repeat that behavior. And if the outcome is not favorable, then the dog is less likely to repeat it. This is generally true for virtually all animals, including people. Unfortunately, the dog training world is full of people who place entirely too much emphasis on the latter part of that statement. However, training is far more effective when you focus on emphasizing what you like more than what you don't like. Think about your favorite teacher when you were in school. Let's say you asked her for help with a particular concept or problem. What did she do? Did she yell at you? Did she blame you for not paying attention? Did she slap you on the wrist? No. She probably said something like, sit down and let's go over it again. I'll help you understand it better. She may have even acknowledged that the concept is hard and that it was okay if you didn't get it instantly. She probably patiently explained things slowly and clearly, and her mood was light. Her goal was simply to make sure she was communicating the lesson effectively to you. Now, think about a teacher you didn't like. Maybe that teacher was annoyed when you asked for clarification. Possibly he blamed you and pointed out all the things you were doing wrong, rather than trying to help you reason through the problem. He might have discouraged you, and you may have even feared him. You probably know what I'm talking about. Many of us, unfortunately, had at least one teacher like that. Compare these two encounters. One teacher probably made you excited about learning, and the other made you dread it. Both approaches may have gotten results, but which do you think was more effective for the long term? Certainly the kind teachers. We can apply these same ideologies in the dog training world. By using positive methods, you will become an understanding, engaging teacher, and your dog will love learning from you. Here are the 6 most important tenets to my dog training program that you need to know to become that favorite teacher. Training principle number 1, bonding with your dog. From the moment you bring your dog home, one of your main focuses should be on the bond with her. That's because having an exceptionally well-behaved dog is primarily a byproduct of having a relationship based on love, respect, and understanding. The good news is that it's easy to bond with dogs. They are hardwired to want to connect with us, so much so that researchers have found that dogs would rather spend time with humans than with their own kennel mates. As much as we love dogs, it turns out they think we're pretty awesome too. Studies have shown that during human-animal interactions, levels of oxytocin, the bonding hormone, increase for both the person and the dog. Also, Gregory Burns, MD, PhD, a neuroscientist at Emory University and author of How Dogs Love Us, spent years studying the canine brain by using MRI technology. By looking at brain activity, he found that dogs and humans experience emotions in a similar way. So how do you bond with your dog? Have fun. The fastest way to achieve a bond with dogs is through activities that involve play, such as fetch, tug of war, or even a game of chase in the backyard. As Plato once said, you can discover more about a person in an hour of play than in a year of conversation. That certainly applies to dogs too. Bonding is also a matter of letting your dog know that she can trust you and depend on you. That means keeping her water bowl filled, feeding and walking her at expected intervals, and speaking to her in a kind voice. You'll find that dogs are pretty easy to bond with once you meet their basic needs and wants. My students become the best teachers to their dogs when they tap into the part of their brain that helps them be good parents. Don't have kids? Me neither. But I think most of us have it within us to learn how to parent someone else. You might think, well, parenting a child and parenting a dog are very different things. True, but there are more similarities than you may realize. One study found that, just as with children, dogs are more likely to interact in an environment where they might otherwise feel apprehensive when they have a secure base, a person they feel confident and secure around. Just as a child might not walk into a birthday party at someone else's house without his mother or father right by his side, a hesitant dog might feel more secure in a new situation because you are next to her. With that reassurance, she may relax enough to explore and play. This isn't anthropomorphizing dogs. This is science. Training principle number 2, the importance of exercise. Like humans, dogs need to keep physically active to stay healthy. However, it's about much more than just their health. From a teaching perspective, you shouldn't expect a moderate to high-energy dog to absorb new concepts and focus on the lesson at hand until she's exercised and used up some of her energy. Also, if your dog has an unwanted behavior, say she likes to shred apart your furniture every time you leave the house, incessantly jump on guests who come to your door, or dig up the backyard, the source is likely a lack of regular mental and physical exercise. Exercise isn't optional for many dogs. It's a necessity. Until around the start of the 20th century, dogs had appropriate outlets for all that energy. Many actually had jobs and performed certain roles such as hunting or herding. Yes, our culture has changed dramatically, and dogs are rarely required to do many of the things they were initially bred to do. That doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to challenge them. For example, My three border collies were specifically bred to herd sheep. And while not all border collies necessarily have the drive and energy for this kind of activity, mine certainly do. Now, I'll confess, I don't have any sheep in my yard here in New Orleans, but I do have frisbees and balls, so I'm able to give my dogs an outlet to work with a person to perform a physical goal. So while they don't herd sheep, they'll chase a ball and bring it back, and this appears to give them great contentment. Dogs at their core require regular interaction with people, and when you couple such interaction with exercise, you can expect better results in training. For low to medium energy dogs, walks, a trip to the dog park, and letting them run around the yard may do the trick. However, for those level 3 dogs who have tons of energy and are always raring to go, those activities aren't going to cut it. So, what will? As I mentioned earlier, playing fetch is the most efficient way to satisfy a dog both mentally and physically. Fetch. Here's what you need to know to teach fetch. 1. First, let's make sure we're talking about the same thing when it comes to fetch. I define the game as follows. You throw a toy, your dog chases it, picks it up, brings it back, and lets it go readily. Your dog is chasing a moving object. This should not be confused with retrieve, your dog picking up a still object off in the distance. It can take a good 2 to 12 weeks for your dog to learn a polished, fluid game of fetch. So don't get frustrated if yours doesn't learn it immediately. Give her some time. 2. Don't use treats. Trying to teach a dog to fetch within minutes of using food is a bad idea in most cases, as the dog is in food mode and less likely to be grabby with her mouth. The reward for a proper fetch should be the toy or object you're playing with, not something edible. 3. Make sure your dog loves the toy you're playing fetch with. That might take a bit of trial and error. When I first got my dog Supernova, he had little interest in playing fetch with the Frisbee. One day I was at a pet supply store with him and noticed that he was fascinated with a cat toy that looked like a feather duster. Instead of thinking, that's not a dog toy, let's keep going, I bought the toy, ripped off the feathers, and taped them to the Frisbee. That was all it took. Supernova has loved playing fetch with his Frisbee ever since and even performed in many Frisbee shows before hundreds of thousands of people in his career. Experiment with a variety of toys. I recommend trying a rope toy at first. And, if necessary, think outside the box. 4. Don't just throw the item and expect your dog to run after it. First, you have to get her really interested in it. Try playing keep away with the item, or pretend you were playing with the toy yourself and having a lot of fun. The idea is to entice your dog to grab it. 5. Play tug of war with the item. This is a critical step of teaching fetch. Once your dog starts playing tug of war with the object, that's a really good sign that she not only loves the object, but is also well on her way to learning fetch. 6. Teach let go. If the key to teaching a dog to like a toy is to make it exciting, then the key to teaching her to let go of the item is to make it uninteresting. Keep the toy in your hand, but make sure it's absolutely still, as though it's in a vise. Also, act bored and dull, as though you couldn't care less that your dog is pulling on the toy. Don't look at her, and certainly don't move the toy in any way. This may take a few seconds or minutes. Be patient. Eventually, your dog will become bored with the toy and let go of it. The split second she does, tell her yes and give the toy back to her as a reward for proper behavior. Most people wait too long to reward with the toy at first during these critical successes. Do your best not to make that mistake. This tells her, I have no problem giving you the toy and playing with you, but you have to play by my rules. Yanking or prying it out of her mouth isn't teaching her anything and will not work as a long-term solution with most dogs. 7. Keep your throws short. The number of reps is more important at this stage, so toss the toy a few feet. As your dog runs to get it, run alongside her, but slightly behind her as to not distract her from the moving toy. Some dogs will pick up the toy at this point, but others need a little encouragement. You might have to point to the toy or nudge it. Then, after your dog picks up the toy, get some eye contact with her and bolt back to the point of origin and encourage her to chase you. Most energetic dogs love to chase. That is reinforced by your insistence that yours chase you. Tug of war and let go are the first two components to teaching fetch. Chase is the third. Once you get that down pat, then run halfway with your dog and encourage her to keep going after the toy. Eventually, you'll run 25% of the distance, and then you won't have to run at all. Training principle number three, learning to communicate. From the second you start training your dog, you need to establish some basic communication with one another. Luckily, dogs are hardwired for that, more so than any other known living being. Brian Hare, PhD, Associate Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke University and co-author of The Genius of Dogs, once said, "Of all the species on this planet, the one that has the gift of reading intentions and understanding what it is that we want to communicate, it's in dogs. It's not in chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest relative. It's actually that dogs really do have cognitive abilities to understand us in a way that some species don't." If you have a puppy or a new dog with little training, then you'll need to accept that it can take some time to establish mutual communication. That's why controlling the environment is vital during this communication building phase, because your dog has yet to learn what you expect of her. This process might feel like it's taking longer than it should, but don't give up. It can take a week or two to lay some groundwork. Once you do, progress will start to speed up quickly. Here's what you need to know to effectively communicate with your dog. Eye contact. Eye contact can play a huge role in communication. Dogs make eye contact with us to gather information about our emotions, when and where they might get fed, or what's going on in a particular situation. Researchers have also found that dogs can follow our gaze and even understand the meaning behind it. Of course, I'm not telling you to stare your dog down. It's just a matter of looking at her in the same way you'd look at another person. Understanding the training bubble, the distance between your eyes and your dog's eyes, will go a long way when teaching your dog eye contact at first. The closer your eyes are to hers, the faster your dog will likely respond. I even recommend sitting on the ground when teaching at first, so you can really get eye level with your dog. Over time, you can stretch that bubble and the distance between you. However, do that slowly or the bubble will pop. More on eye contact and how to teach look at me in Chapter 6. Hand signals. Think about it. If you ever met someone who didn't know your language, you might use a lot of hand signals to communicate with one another initially. Well, it's the same thing with dogs. They might have no idea what we're saying at first, and they'll never fully understand everything we say, but hand signals and body language help communicate what we want. That's why when teaching dogs, I always point, gesture, and use exaggerated body language in addition to using words and encouragement. Some dogs are more responsive to hand signals than words, and vice versa. Time will tell which one your dog prefers. But in the beginning, be sure to incorporate a lot of body language. Feel free to make up any hand signals you'd like. Don't take it for granted that dogs understand our hand signals. They're able to do so in a way no other species can. As Dr. Hare explains, in direct comparisons between dogs and apes, dogs are more skilled at using human gestures to find hidden food or objects. For instance, he and other researchers found that if you take two cups and put a treat under one of them and then point to it or even gaze at it, a dog is more likely than a chimpanzee to go towards the correct cup. Researchers have ruled out the possibility that dogs simply use their sense of smell to find food. The dogs actually follow the human's gestures to locate the correct cup. We've interpreted this to mean that dogs understand the communicative intentions of humans in a way that chimpanzees do not, says Dr. Hare. It seems dogs are remarkable for their ability to understand our gestures in a flexible way. Teaching your language. The average dog's ability to understand our vocabulary is on a par with that of a young child. So don't hold back when it comes to teaching your dog your language. When you're ready to teach your dog what a word means, and that when you say it, you'd like to see a specific action, it's important to keep a few things in mind. Let's take down as an example, as in lie down, not related to jumping. Say it once, not down, 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 down. There are two problems with repeating a word multiple times. First, your dog might think that the word you're saying is actually down, 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 down. Second, Even if your dog does eventually learn that you are simply repeating down four times, she might interpret that as a precedent to regularly wait until you get to the fourth request. There are exceptions to this. For instance, you might occasionally give a request, say down, and then repeat it once for emphasis if you want your dog to remain in that position longer than a few seconds. Yes, down. However, that's quite different from saying the word you're teaching repeatedly on a regular basis. Instead, be clear and concise. If your dog does not do the thing you've taught her, simply say no and withhold the reward. You might just need to take a break. Also, keep in mind that teaching basic vocabulary can take a few weeks. When first teaching a word to a dog, it's also important to say the word after she performs the skill. So, using the example of down, encourage your dog into a down position using allure and hand signals, as I explained in Chapter 6. The second she lies down, give her a treat, and then say down. Slowly, one time, at normal volume. No need to shout, and with purpose. Learning your dog's communication cues. Teaching our dogs to understand us is important, but it's just as important that we learn to understand them. A relationship is a two-way street. Anyone who has ever lived with a dog knows that the different barks, growls, and whines they make, and their various expressions, all mean something. I'd bet that you could probably differentiate between your dog's bark that means a stranger is approaching, and a playful bark, or one that indicates hunger. Also, dogs express how they're feeling through their body language just as we do. Certain dog postures and movements can help you tell the difference between a growl that says, "Let's play," and one that says, "Back away." What your pet's body language means will vary based on the individual dog and the actual situation. For example, my dog Alpha Centauri will stand still like a statue with a closed mouth and an intense stare. Outsiders might interpret this as a sign of aggression. However, in my dog's case, it almost always means, "Please, I will do anything if you will just throw a toy for me right now." Context is everything. Keeping in mind the importance of getting to know your dog's cues and the circumstances under which they occur, here are some things to look for in general. Tail. When it's upright, that usually indicates interest. If it's wagging side to side in combination with other body language that appears to be happy, that probably means the dog's excited or wants to play. Slow, deliberate wags could mean the dog is uncertain about a situation, while a tail tucked between a dog's legs may indicate fear and anxiety. Ears. When these are pulled back, a dog may be fearful or anxious, relaxed, or simply listening to what's behind her. When pricked forward, the dog is probably on high alert or very interested in something. Eyes. As you get to know your dog, you'll instantly be able to assess her mood and get an idea of what she might be thinking by looking into her eyes. If you notice her pupils are dilated, her eyes are darting from side to side, or you see the whites of her eyes, she may be afraid of something. A direct, intense stare may indicate a threat or a strong desire to interact with you, but remember, there are exceptions to this. Mouth. Scared dogs may keep their mouths closed or have their teeth bared and lips curled. A dog who is feeling anxious may pant and lick her lips often. However, a dog whose mouth is open with her tongue out is possibly playful or relaxed. Though, if she's panting, that could mean she's either uneasy or overheated. Posture. While shy or scared dogs may crouch low to the ground, confident ones may stand tall. If a dog seems natural and relaxed, this probably means she's easygoing in that setting. Training principle number 4, be consistent. The hallmark of any truly successful dog trainer is consistency. Until you get good at this, your dog will not listen to you or understand you in the way that you probably want. I can't overemphasize this point. Yes, it takes some effort to be consistent, but it's really not that difficult. For example, if you ask your dog to come and she doesn't, then it's on you to snap into training mode for a few seconds or minutes and motivate her to come to you, regardless of what you're busy doing. You gave the request, now see it through, and make sure you get the result you want. You may have to grab a treat and lure your dog every step of the way from where you called her from, or possibly escort her on a leash. But this is what it means to be consistent. Also, when something happens that you don't like, then it's your mandate to make sure it doesn't happen again. Every instance in which your dog performs an action you don't want means it will take more time to resolve. Say your dog rushes into another room after you've asked her to stay, and you don't call her back and repeat this training exercise. You've made an error in your consistency, which may eventually snowball into a dog who listens and responds to requests only on occasion. If you notice that your puppy is chewing on the table leg, you need to divert her attention to something else that is acceptable to chew on every single time. See Chapter 7 for the troubleshooting section on chewing. In a nutshell, be relentlessly consistent, and I promise you'll get great results. Training principle number 5, control the environment. Again, the number one mistake made by new pet parents is giving their dogs too much freedom too early by not controlling their environment enough. This is absolutely essential to effective training. Don't just wing it. Dogs are very smart, but without guidance from us, they have no idea how to interact in our culture. When I have a new dog, my protocol is to attach a 4 to 6 foot leash to my belt loop during the day so that when I get up to go to the kitchen, check the mail, or do yard work, my dog is with me. This not only allows you to prevent your dog from inquiring about the expensive shoes you left by the front door, but also gives you the opportunity to avert or interrupt potential behaviors you don't wish to see repeated. Most important, it also gives you many more opportunities to notice your dog doing things you like so that you can communicate your pleasure with her. For best results, attach your dog to you or make sure she's in a puppy-proofed area the first few weeks or months of training. That way, bad habits won't even get started. Your goal is to put your dog in a setting where she is not able to do something you don't want. Training principle number 6, train from the inside out. If you want long-term, meaningful results with your dog, your goal should be not to make your dog do something, which I call outside-in training, but to make your dog want to do something on her own, called inside-out training. The idea behind outside-in training is that if you make your dog's life momentarily unpleasant, you will discourage certain behavior in the future. This strategy is called experiential avoidance, and I find it less than ideal. As I've explained, traditional dog trainers focus on correcting behavior through outside influences, including leash jerking, manhandling, and devices such as metal choke chains or prong collars that, when quickly popped or jerked around a dog's neck, cause discomfort or outright pain, as a way to communicate, don't do that. These trainers actually bank on a dog misbehaving or messing up just so they can teach her a lesson. This is an amateurish, antiquated approach. Remember, we are capable of communicating with dogs much more intelligently than this. There are many problems with outside-in training. First and foremost, it does nothing to promote the bond between a person and a dog, a bond that is vital during the training process. To me, that alone is immediate grounds for dismissal of this type of training. I see little point in teaching a dog if you can't both enjoy it. I want the dogs I train to be buzzing and loving life to the max, not just because I respect them, but also because I know that's how they learn best. What's more, outside-in training rarely, if ever, leads to long-lasting results, as I explained in this chapter. Physically forcing your dog to do something, even if it's as simple and benign as pushing her behind down into a sit position, doesn't teach her in a meaningful way that encourages her to think for herself. It's simply too shallow a way to teach a complex animal like a dog. I'm not saying not to touch your dog ever during training. For instance, if she needs assistance getting out of the pool, by all means help her. I'm just saying that you shouldn't rely on physically controlling her as a primary training strategy if you want the best results. Inside-out training, on the other hand, encourages our dogs to use their sophisticated brains. When they do think for themselves and behave a certain way because they've been taught to do so by you, then they'll more likely repeat that behavior of their own accord. You'll also see results a lot faster, and your dog will be more prepared for the years ahead. So, how do you get your dog to think from the inside out? A Along with learning how to bond and communicate with your dog, it's a matter of showing your dog the right thing to do and then making her life awesome when she does it by rewarding her with a treat or playtime and genuine praise. Stop and think how you felt as a child when an authority figure gave you sincere praise. Maybe you aced a test and your teacher announced that you had the highest score in the class. I'd bet you tried extra hard to have a repeat performance. I know that I certainly advanced faster as a child when my parents or teachers cheered me on and recognized my accomplishments. That's what we want to do with our dogs. Inside-out training also addresses the cause of the problem, not the symptom. For instance, if your dog is chewing on the table leg, applying bitter-tasting sprays isn't going to stop your dog from wanting to chew. She may avoid that table leg until the spray wears off, but she hasn't learned not to chew up your house and possessions. Tools such as these are just bandages, but they don't get to the root of the issue, which in the case of chewing is most likely boredom or teething. You'll see that everything I'll teach is geared toward addressing the cause, and this will make all the difference. Ask Zach. Stubbornness. I'm not sure what to think when my dog relieves herself in the house, even though she knows she shouldn't, or when I call her to me and she doesn't budge. Is she being stubborn? I hear this all the time, and I get it. Dogs, and especially puppies, do things we wish they wouldn't, especially if we let our guard down. Potty accidents are inevitable. Puppy biting sets off even the most patient people. Also, dogs may seem to understand a concept such as sit or come, but they don't always do it when you ask. I understand why some people automatically blame their dog and say she's being stubborn, but don't do it. In cases when your dog does something you don't like, you need to figure out how not to make that mistake again that led to the unwanted behavior. For example, if your dog has a potty accident in the house, that means she's not fully house trained yet. What do we do when a baby goes in her diaper? We change the diaper and move on because we know that the baby has not had enough time to learn to do otherwise. In the case of your dog, you should clean up the accident, take her out more often for longer periods of time, and do a better job of supervising her or putting her in an environment such as a crate where she is unlikely to repeat the behavior. Getting mad at your dog and in turn yelling at her or physically disciplining her in any way is not going to help and threatens to compromise the most important part of training, the bond between you. If you've already done this, just get back on track. Dogs don't hold grudges easily and will likely move on quickly. Just remember that any mistakes your dog makes are most likely a sign that you need to do more training and spend more time building communication. Same goes for when your dog doesn't perform a behavior you ask her to do. So if she doesn't come when you call her, focus on the fundamentals again. The best trainers in the world are those who take a step back in their training without hesitation. For instance, your dog might come when you're a few feet away from her at home, but not at a greater distance or when there are distractions. Remember, dogs don't quickly generalize a concept, and when there's a change in a major variable, such as a new environment, they need to relearn the concept at first. Also, your dog may not respond when you ask her to do something because you haven't weaned her off treats appropriately, so she's always expecting one. Lastly, remember that dogs aren't computers, so you shouldn't expect perfection all the time. In fact, in general, you should always focus on progress, not perfection. If you want your dog to, say, chase a ball, but she doesn't budge, she may just be exhausted. By not moving, it's as though she's saying, "Sorry, we just got back from that long walk. I'm too tired to play right now." Or maybe you haven't gone through the necessary steps to pique your dog's interest in the toy. It's important to respect that. Together time. When I'm relaxing on the couch at night, my dog doesn't want to snuggle. She prefers to sleep under the coffee table. While she can be playful at times, she mostly likes to keep to herself. Why doesn't she like me? Just like humans, dogs are individuals and completely diverse in their personalities. Some are shy, some are outgoing. Some like to be on top of you 24/7, others want their space. I couldn't possibly be more bonded with Venus than I already am. However, she just doesn't like being cuddled. I can give her a pet or a hug, and she enjoys a loving moment for a minute, but then she moves on. When I'm watching TV, she'd prefer to leave the room rather than plop down next to me. She never likes to sleep in bed with me. Supernova, on the other hand, is the total opposite. He's by my side at all times and follows me from room to room. At night, not only does he want to sleep in my bed with me, but he also wants to lie smack up against me. I know that doesn't mean Supernova loves me more than Venus does. He's just a different dog. Even if your dog isn't very demonstrative, that doesn't mean you can't encourage a bit of affection. Again, it's important to cater to your dog's personality. For instance, if she's a more reserved dog, don't try to wrestle with her or play rough. Instead, take a gentle approach and pet her softly. Appreciate your dog's innate personality, and if she wants to just chill out by your feet, know that that's her way of saying, I want to be with you. Fetch. I try playing fetch with my dog, but she doesn't seem to have a good handle on it. What should I do? I hear this all the time. Fetch training is a little more involved than most people realize, and it can take a few weeks or considerably longer for your dog to learn it well. Most people give up on fetch training prematurely, but I beg you not to. There's definitely a learning curve. It's like when people test out new video games. At first, they may get frustrated and lose interest because they don't get it. However, once they do, watch out, they're hooked. It's the same thing with fetch. You may run into some roadblocks. For instance, I already explained in this chapter what to do to make sure your dog lets go of the toy when playing fetch. Here are some tips for handling some other common problems. 1. My dog chases and picks up the toy, but doesn't bring it back. This is a sign that you need to dial it back a bit. First, make your throws shorter. When you throw the toy and your dog picks it up, start running in the opposite direction and be animated. This will encourage your dog to chase you toward the point of origin. Gradually decrease the distance you're running in the opposite direction until she stops where you ideally want her to stop. 2. My dog plays for a few throws but seems to get bored. This is very normal. One option is to try to give your dog a 5 to 20 minute break and then try playing fetch again. She may just need a breather. Also, try dialing it up a notch with the enthusiasm. Jump around, wave the toy in the air, and do whatever you can to make the toy and yourself seem like a lot of fun. Forget about your dignity. Remember, it takes time for dogs to become addicted to fetch. Trust me, soon yours will probably never want to stop. 3. My dog plays fetch inside, but never outside. Changing your dog's surroundings will throw her off in almost any area of training, and that includes fetch. Plus, when you're outside, there are so many distractions that can monopolize your dog's attention. A car whizzing by, new smells, another dog barking in the distance, a stick lying in the grass. The key is to reteach fetch in the new environment and know that while some dogs may pick it up again quickly, others might take a few weeks. Also, when you first go outside, let your dog become acclimated to the new environment and explore around a little bit. That way, she can satisfy her curiosity and then get into the game of fetch. 4. I've tried playing fetch with my dog dozens of times. She really doesn't like it. Do you have any other options? While fetch is the ideal exercise to help stimulate your dog mentally and physically, I understand that not every dog out there is ultimately going to be a fan of it. However, you've got to let your dog burn off some energy if you expect her to behave and concentrate during training sessions, especially if she's high energy. Some other options include long hikes, agility courses, and swimming.